allotted 20 minutes for this case, but the issues are pretty well defined.
Yes, sir.
We may not need all of that 20 minutes.
I agree. Anyway.
But go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Kurt Jackson. I represent the appellant, Brett Earl. There's no question that the standard of review in this case is de novo. When the abuse of discretion standard applies on a motion for summary judgment, or a motion for summary judgment is merely a conduit through which the district court decides the legal question, and it doesn't have to follow the usual tests of summary judgment, such as whether or not there's a genuine issue of material fact or credibility. However, in an ERISA case such as this, when the standard is de novo and a case may be decided by summary judgment, but the district court still must abide by the standards of summary judgment. In other words, summary judgment cannot be granted if there exist genuine issues of material fact and credibility. When conducting the de novo review, the district court can order matters outside the administrative record, and that's what the district court did here, and no one's complaining about that. But what that additional information did is it created a number of issues of fact and credibility which are disputed. And we just don't think that the district court was in a posture to grant summary judgment in this case based upon the de novo review. The district court should have denied any summary judgment for LINA.
There's one thing I just want to clarify.
Sure.
That is, when, you know, when Mr. Earl was first awarded disability benefits, there's no dispute that they applied the correct policy definition?
I don't know. I think there is a dispute, because what they're saying is that when they did that, they used the policy which they now say is the one which governs. We say that there's a different policy, so I can't agree that when they first initiated or determined the benefits, they were acting under the correct policy, because I think it's clear that there's a different policy.
All right, this raises a question I had. In your reply brief, you state appellees testified under oath that there exists a policy entitling Earl to continue long-term disability benefits under disability definition paragraph 2. I couldn't find that testimony in the record. Could you point to that testimony? It didn't appear to me there was such testimony. And if there was, you had no cite in your reply brief to the excerpt after that statement. And I just wondered if you
would
find it in the record.
Sure. It's included in both the depositions of Andrea Sidney and Karen Nichols. And they're in the excerpts of record. And she testified that...
Oh, excerpts of record where?
Okay. I'm looking for it here. She testified that when she reviewed this claim, she looked at a different policy that was on her desk, and she applied disability definition paragraph 2.
That clearly is one of the facts... But you said testifies there exists a policy, and there was a mistake obviously made here.
I don't think it's obvious that it's a mistake.
Well, all right.
I mean, if there was a mistake, then it's a pretty elaborate mistake when this woman gets a policy that she relies on and tells Mr. Earl that he's entitled to benefits under this policy, and then actually denies benefits under paragraph 2 and tells him he's not entitled to it.
I understand those facts, but you said testified under oath that there exists a policy, and that's
right.
What I couldn't find, that testimony under oath. I don't waste your time now if you later find it and just submit it to the court, because to me, the simple question in this case is what were the terms of the insurance policy? And if there is such testimony, that would be important. But if there is no such testimony...
On page 44 of the excerpts of record, which is the deposition of Andrea Sidney, the question, you told Brett Earl in that letter that according to that policy, the definition of disability had two parts. Yes. And you told him that if And you told him that he is disabled if either one of those two events occurred, correct? Yes, sir. And one of those was if he was unable to earn 80% or more of his index-covered earnings, correct? Yes, I did. And she wrote that letter based upon a policy that she used, and I'm still trying to find it.
That was her understanding at the time. I guess it's an interpretation of what that testimony means. She thought there was something.
She didn't think. On page 48 of the excerpts of record, you say that you included the paragraph 2 definition, that is the 80% earnings definition, by copying it from a different policy on your desk. Is that correct? To the best of my correct recollection, sir. And I asked her, well, do you recall actually doing that? Or are you testifying that that's probably what must have happened? She says, I'm testifying that that probably, in fact, is what happened. So we have a dispute. We have an issue of fact and credibility. This policy that this lady used and relied on it to tell Mr. Earl that he's entitled to these benefits, but not only did she just tell him that he would be entitled if he satisfied the definition, she went ahead and denied it on that basis, and so did Karen Nichols, her supervisor, on page 85 of the excerpts of record. Karen Nichols' deposition. I asked her, starting at line 19 on page 85 of the excerpts, where does it say 80% of the index-covered earnings? I'm asking her if she denied his benefits based upon the second definition. And she says it doesn't say that. It says it's within his salary range. And I says, okay, and you take that to mean that you're denying it based on the second part of the deposition? No, I denied it on both. So in other words, not only do they use this policy, but they actually deny the benefits based upon that second definition of the policy. Well,
now the district court said that was a mistake, that the policy that applies here only contained the first limitation, not the second, and you had a couple of employees who mistakenly were advising your client as to what they thought his policy contained when it didn't.
The problem with that is that the district judge was doing that on a summary judgment motion.
Yeah, and but the policy says it cannot be amended in this fashion.
This is not an amendment. This is a totally different policy, which contains two definitions.
How did it get to be his policy? Can the employee create the policy?
I don't think an employee can create the policy. I think they can use a policy which applies, and they said that they used a policy which applies here. The policy which ended up in the administrative record, you have to understand, I asked this both of these claims people, well, did you review the entire administrative record before you wrote these letters? And they says, yes, that's what we do. Well, if they did that, how in the world did they not use the policy which would eventually ended up in the administrative record?
Have you ever found that policy?
No, that's the problem. That's why on this summary judgment motion.
What's this policy that's dated April 1, 1991? Nalco Chemical Company.
That's the policy, I believe, that Nalco said, or excuse me, LINA says is part of the administrative record. I asked how the administrative record is compiled when I deposed these two people. And I asked him, was that policy, the one that's bait stamped 0 to 31, I believe, or 33, was that policy in the administrative record when you reviewed this thing and wrote these letters to this man saying he would be entitled to benefits under two definitions? And they said, we don't know. I said, well, how is the file compiled? Well, usually it's compiled with the newest information first, and then as later information comes, they stack it up. They didn't know when that policy was bait stamped. They don't know if it was in the administrative record when they were writing these letters denying these benefits. The only thing they could tell me was that they used this policy with these two definitions. My point is that when the district court is deciding a case on summary judgment, a de novo review, it's not its prerogative to decide whether that one's right or that one's right.
Let me ask you this. When you were in summary, when you were taking the deposition, I didn't go through the entire deposition. But Mr. Earle worked for Nalco, correct?
Yes, sir.
From 1995 through 2000, correct?
I think that's the undisputed facts.
And this policy was in the one that's dated April 91, was issued on behalf of Nalco Chemical. Did you trace through which policies had been issued to the employer in return for benefits provided? I mean, you had them in deposition.
We didn't get an opportunity to. I mean, and I guess we were resisting summary judgment. We were trying to avoid summary judgment. And I think we raised all these factual issues which need to be determined. I guess I wasn't in a position to be able to do that.
Well, it seems to me that you had raised a question with the district court judge about which was the correct policy that applied to your client.
Right.
So it seemed to me that you might want to.
Well, I did. I asked.
You might want to try and determine at the outset that when your client was employed by Nalco, what policy was in effect at that time.
Right.
And once you zeroed in on what policy was in effect at that time, then you could determine whether or not these later on in 2003 there was a mistake that was made.
You have to understand that what we were doing was responding to these letters that these women wrote, which says that this policy contained two definitions. And then we get in the administrative record a policy which contained one definition. So I took the depositions of these women and say, how can that be? And they said, well, there's another policy. And I asked them, well, did you handle any other claims? You know, I had these two lower-level women to talk about this whole thing that you're raising. And when they said, I don't know, I mean, I've never handled any other claims, the district court issued an order before I took the depositions of these two women, say, produce everything you relied on in denying this claim. And I asked Andrea Sidney, I believe the first woman, did anybody show you Judge Haddon's order? No. Did anybody tell you about it? No. Did you take any measures to try to find this other policy? No. I asked the people who we were allowed to depose where this other policy was, and we didn't get any answer. In oral argument, Judge Haddon asked counsel, counsel obviously is not a witness and not under oath, and I think did his best to answer the question. He says, I don't know what measures we've taken to find this other policy. And I just think that on a summary judgment motion where there are all of these issues existing as to does this policy exist, is he entitled to benefits under the second definition, that's clearly an issue of fact. I think everybody agrees about that. The problem is that I think when Judge Haddon decided this case on summary judgment, he was actually making findings of fact and making credibility judgments and making value judgments. He said that Andrea Sidney and Karen Nichols' work on the case was sloppy or maybe incompetent. Those are Judge Haddon's words, not mine. But I guess the point is that on a summary judgment motion, those are definitely value judgments and credibility determinations, which I don't think you can make. And I'll just say one more thing. The case should be remanded, I think, under Carney, where Judge Kleinfeld said even if the standard of review on a remand is still going to be de novo, and even if the district judge ends up looking at the very same thing he looked at in summary judgment, the calculus is different because he's got to make findings of fact under Rule 52 and be more specific. I mean, Judge Haddon was pretty general saying, I don't find any credible evidence that there is this other policy in the face of these depositions, which says that there is. Instead of that global determination that I don't find any credible evidence, he's going to have to make specific findings on why he doesn't think so. So we think that summary judgment was improper and it should be remanded. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Andrew Ringel. With me at counsel table is Kevin O'Brien, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellee in this case. A couple things that I wanted to say. I think the frame of this decision is what the district court said at excerpts of record page 110. The district court said this: "It seems to me, counsel, that the issue, when stripped of its other components, comes down to this, and that is, does this court have the capacity, and if so, should it exercise that capacity to, in effect, amend the policy that was in place because of the content of the denial letters and the manner and circumstances under which that letter was produced as it is outlined in the depositions?" There's no basis under ERISA and the law of ERISA to allow either the district court, as the district court concluded, or this court to amend the policy. And that's the fundamental barrier of the plaintiff's argument.
Well, but I my initial question was further back, which is, which policy was it? The 91 policy, is that the one that applied here?
That's correct, Your Honor.
He says that there's a factual dispute over that.
There is not a factual dispute.
So explain to me why that's the policy that applies, and then by what happened later, years later, is nothing more than a mistake.
Okay. Here's the reason, Your Honor. As part of the district court record, and it's in the docket sheet, there was a certification of the policy that you referred to in 1991 as the policy that applied between Life Insurance Company of North America and Nalco Chemical Company. Okay? That's the policy. What Ms. Sidney referenced, this other policy, as counsel for the plaintiff talks about, was on her desk, is a policy that is another policy unknown applying to a different employer other than Nalco.
What did you do, Mr. Ringel, to establish that this group long-term disability policy, which you've included in your supplemental excerpt of 11, what did you do to establish that that was the policy that applied to Mr. Earle?
There was a certification of that policy.
It said this policy was in effect for a certain period of time. This was the only policy that this company had on this subject, and this person was an employee and subject to that policy. Did you present some evidence to that effect?
Well, we presented the evidence is as follows, Your Honor. Okay. There was a certification that this was the policy that was in effect at the time. There wasn't time? Part of the certification what you said.
At what time?
At the time of Mr. Earle's injury and application and consideration for long-term disability benefits under the policy. There were affidavits and then deposition testimony from Andrea Sidney and Karen Nichols that they made a mistake, that this was not the language they quoted that included the 80% index covered earnings. Second part of the deposition of the definition of disability wasn't part of the actual policy till Nalco. Now, there isn't any evidence, and I think Your Honor's question to my colleague is appropriate, there isn't any evidence that contradicts it. There's evidence in the depositions that say there was a policy, a different policy that was relied upon and quoted in those letters. What happened was Ms. Sidney quoted the wrong definition of disability, and Ms. Nichols replicated the error because she used Ms. Sidney's letter as a frame to, you know, to make the appeal. But there's no link.
Excuse me if I'm interrupt for a minute. Sometime around April 9th, 2003, your client requested a vocational assessment of Mr. Earle to determine if he was physically able to perform long-term from occupations that meet, and this is the earnings requirement of his long-term disability contract. Doesn't this suggest your client understood the contract to include a definition of disabled as being unable to earn a certain salary?
Well, I believe the record reflects that that's Ms. Sidney that made the same error. So she must have.
She just made one mistake after another.
Well, and if we were not in an ERISA case, and this was a negligence case, or if this was a promissory estoppel case under Montana law, you might have an ability, and the district court might have an ability to give a remedy to Mr. Earl. But the problem here is this is an ERISA case, and there's no mechanism under ERISA.
Well, no, it's not a matter. You're probably correct that, you know, you can't. We certainly have no authority to amend it, but it could be. One possibility here is that the 91 policy was in effect when Mr. Earl started work at NALCO or during, you know, that period of time, after 95. But over time, you know, the policy changed.
Well, that supposition, while clearly possible, is
and
not supported by
what counsel was trying to argue was that what happened in 203 and 204, whenever that was, you know, the reevaluation, that raises a question, a genuine dispute about whether the policy was ever amended by, you know, change, you know, that the employer and the insurance company bargained for a better policy. It does happen. You know, employers sometimes do decide to give their employees a better side package, you know, a little greater benefits for their hard work. And that does happen.
I understand that, and I agree that employers do that. And I don't think that there's any evidence that supports that that's what occurred here.
And insurance companies, when the employers do that, then insurance companies can charge a higher premium for this better policy.
That's correct. But what I would say is this. The record is we certified the policy. This is the policy that applies. The only evidence that they have that there might be a different policy never provides the factual link between the policy that Andrea Sidney may have relied upon and NALCO. And that's the fundamental factual link that does not exist in that case. In this case, and absent their putting forward evidence, or, as Your Honor indicated, just trying to discover such evidence, the house of cards falls apart. There's no way to link this policy, this other policy, with NALCO and therefore apply it to Brett Earl. Now, that may not be fair, but there is no evidence.
Let me ask you this. I can't remember, but, you know, the documents or these policy provisions that they were looking at when they wrote these letters, did they ever link that with a policy that was really for another employer? I mean, they say this policy applies to, you know, Remington Manufacturing.
We just made a
gross mistake.
They didn't, Your Honor, and there's no way to know. I mean, Life Insurance Corporation of North America has all sorts of different policies that have a variable different definitions, and there was no linkage between the policy language and the letter in any particular policy, Remington, North America, or whatever it
but
might
you
be.
would think that between NALCO and the insurance company that there would be somebody would have a file about that contains policy.
Well, and that's what I
would say to the employees, right?
The insurance company certified that this is the policy that's in effect, and there's no contrary evidence other than speculation that there must have been another policy because of what was misquoted in the language of the letter. I would also point out this. There's other evidence that the district court considered that the actual language is the language of the policy. One, it's what's contained in the summary plan description, and that's in your record. Two, there are two letters, one from Richard Trujillo, one from Karen Silby, that predate Andrea Sidney's letter, that both quote the definition of disability in exact terms as the policy itself. You know, the other thing I'd point out is plaintiff moved for summary judgment too. This was before the district court on cross motions for summary judgment. So the notion that there's this embedded disputed issue of fact is inconsistent with plaintiffs
well,
having
we only moved look at your motion. The district court granted your motion, so we only look at your motion.
I understand that, Your Honor.
In that context. By the way, do you agree that the standard of review here is de novo?
That's correct, Your Honor. We stipulated that at the district court. We're not arguing abuse of discretion here. The two arguments and the two handles that plaintiff tries to give this court to amend the policy are we didn't give him the evidence that was relied upon, and the remedy there is a de novo review in front of the district court, which is what he got.
I'm not looking to amend the policy.
Well, the plaintiff is. I mean,
but no, it could be that the policy changed over a period of time.
Well, but it didn't, Your Honor.
Sometimes these policies are static and they don't change, but, you know, it's possible.
I understand that. And it would have behooved the plaintiff to do a 30B6 deposition or something to try to get at that issue. But the record on summary judgment is absent, and it's not the purpose of this Court to reach out and say, we're going to help counsel for the plaintiff in our adversary system ask the right questions. They're factual.
Let me ask you this. The district court's discovery, you know, the district court allowed this little discovery.
Correct.
Would a 30B6 deposition have been encompassed within that?
It was not requested by counsel for the plaintiff. So it could have been something that they would have requested and tried to get a handle on just what you're saying. What is the history of all of the policies with NALCO? But they didn't ask that question. And counsel is quite right. Andrea Sidney and Karen Nichols are not people that would have been able to answer that question because they're not high enough on the food chain enough to know the answer to that. But it's
they,
not.
They alone could not amend the policy.
That's correct. As Judge Thompson pointed out, the policy language itself says it can only be amended in writing by a policy holder and someone who is a higher-ranking official from the insurance company. Neither Ms. Sidney nor Ms. Nichols fall into that category. I mean, you know, it may be that Congress in its infinite wisdom could amend ERISA and change it so that people like Mr. Earle have a remedy. But there isn't a remedy under ERISA that allows the amendment of a policy to provide Mr. Earle with a definition of disability that isn't in the policy that is undisputed before the court. And it doesn't create a disputed issue of fact to say there was some other policy when there's no linkage between that policy and NALCO or Mr. Earle. Unless the court has further questions, I'm going to sit down. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
With all due respect, counsel's arguments sound like those that he should be making at a trial and not before an appellate court, because the arguments themselves raise issues of fact and credibility about where all of these things are. On page 49 of the excerpts of record, I asked Andrea Sidney again whether or not she was given Judge Haddon's order about, you know, produce everything you relied on. And I asked her, well, what efforts have you undertaken to attempt to determine what policies have that type of definition in them? None, sir. None, none. The district court exercises discretion to allow a discovery. But in that exercise of discretion, we were given two people whom to depose. And we deposed those people. And basically because they were the ones who made the decision that there's another policy, not an amended version of the first policy, but a different policy. I suppose it could be an amended version of the first policy or the one that they ended up in the administrative record. But we did make efforts to try to do this. And I think what we did in taking these depositions was raise these issues of fact on some which cannot be decided on a summary judgment proceeding. All of these favorable inferences about there being another definition were decided unfavorably to Mr. Earle. And I don't think that's proper on a motion for summary judgment. There was a vocational evaluation to try to determine whether or not this man could earn 80% of his wages. That would be a futile exercise if the policy didn't contain that definition. We have disputed from the very beginning that the policy which ended up in the administrative record was the one that applies in this case.
How do you respond to counsel's comment that the summary plan description is consistent with the policy that's in the administrative record, the 91 policy?
If it's consistent, it's inconsistent with everything else that went on.
Well, you know, on summary judgment, you know, the district court can say, you know, there's a, you know, I recognize that there's some dispute here, but no reasonable trier of fact could ever agree with the position you're arguing.
Well, I don't think, you know, the judge is in a position to make that determination.
But a district court judge can do that. You can grant summary judgment by saying, there are no facts in dispute, and as a matter of law, you're entitled to summary judgment. Or you can say, conclude that there's such a minimal dispute here, look at all the evidence, and conclude that no reasonable trier of fact could make a different finding.
Well, I don't think he can say minimal or maximum. I think if he finds anything, there's no summary judgment.
No.
And I think that if there exists...
The district court's job on summary judgment is to determine whether there's a factual dispute. Even if the district court judge were to find a dispute, it doesn't preclude the district court judge from granting summary judgment if he concludes that in light of all the evidence, no reasonable trier of fact would not otherwise, would conclude differently.
I think a judge can do that, but that judge didn't do that in this case. He actually, decided credibility issues and weighed the evidence unfavorably to our point of view. And I think there's just way too many factual and credibility issues for him to have done that.
Okay. Thank you so much. We appreciate counsel's argument.